A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost. I'm here every weekday on digital and online from 9 until 1 o'clock with my producer Annie Weston, making that pound in your pocket go a little further. Well, coming up, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. On behalf of us, they investigate everything from scams, how to keep the cost down on your household bills, and the best deals out there. Well, this week they've been looking at pensioner bonds, balance transfer cards, and our love of cars, although not French ones, it seems. Oh, and very festively appropriate, the subject of turkeys. Just when you thought you'd had your fill of crazy shopping days, crazy days that are named in general, the madness of Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Manic Monday. I'm not talking about festive Christmas jumper day either. No, I'm talking about Mayhem Monday. Oh yes, that's coming up as well, 22nd December. And we've been asking a lot today about young people and careers, hearing from a businessman who at 15 years old knew exactly what he wanted to be when he grew up and went on to build a multi-million pound plumbing company. So we've been asking today, what did you want to be when you grew up and what are you doing now? Annie?
So, what have people been up to then? Well, Laura Ann Coventry on Twitter is saying that she wanted to be a poet or an astronaut, quite different. But investment PR is what she's ended up doing, and it's very, very similar, she says. Donna Ferguson has said, I wanted to be a romantic novelist. How I ended up writing about finance is still a mystery to me. And Jeff said he wanted to be a Power Ranger. He said he was deadly serious about it. He now works in retail. Sandra wanted to be an intrepid explorer and now works in a travel agency. She says she's nearly there.
That's all right.
That's cute. I like that. And Tom said he wanted to be Fireman Sam and he now runs his own business.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
A veterinary nurse. Fancied that. But then I brought a dog home on my work experience for a week. So I thought, nah, I can't do that. My house isn't big enough.
Changed your mind.
Yep.
So now you're here with us.
Hello. I'm here with you. I'm still living the dream.
Absolutely. Aren't we all living the dream? Well, I'm going to bring in now, this is money journalist Ed Monk and Lee Boyce, because I want to ask them, lads, what did you want to be when you grew up? And what are you? Well, we know what you are now.
Yeah, you know what we are now. I don't think I grew up sort of desperately wanting to be one thing or the other. I do remember quite fancying being, you know, on sort of David Attenborough wildlife show, and they have camera teams and they sort of live in the Arctic for months and film penguins, things like that.
So not David, you wanted to be...
No, I wanted to be, a sort of in a sort of tent with just filming stuff, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure you've done some of that though with This Is Money.
In a tent? No, sadly, in an office.
So close.
So close. And I think, you probably needed to know stuff about animals and I'm not very scientific or biological.
Any good with cameras?
Well,
no, not really. So that was the end of your career. Lee, yourself?
It's not quite as interesting, but I remember vividly wanting to become an estate agent. Don't ask me but I remember being in primary school and drawing sort of like plans of houses and valuing them and doing a whole document sheet for them.
Wow.
Strange child.
Lee, I'm seeing you in a whole new light. But before I let you talk about important matters, this is an important matter because we're being encouraged to wear some festive knitwear today for Christmas Jumper Day, the annual event for Save the Children, brought in more than £1.3 million last year. And it seems Christmas jumpers are becoming increasingly popular, with one supermarket saying they've seen a 160% increase in interest. Terence Lovell from Save the Children thinks Christmas jumpers are something of a guilty pleasure.
It's something which lets out a bit of fun at Christmas, enables us to enjoy that festive spirit and really hark back to the memories of jumpers that grandma might have knitted or the jumpers that we've always wanted to secretly buy.
Guilty pleasure? People who are having fun, living the spirit, like me, in my festive jumper with a bear on it and a pom-pom. I am the only one, not just in the studio, no. Not even in Annie's studio, in the whole office, wearing a Christmas jumper. But apparently, lads, you think it's so last season.
we should be careful what we say. It is for charity, and that's a good thing. But it is a bit 2 years ago, isn't it? Isn't it?
I agree.
And I know the chap from Save the Children explained that it might be a jumper knitted by your grandmother, but it might be one bought from Primark.
It is like a bomb site of Christmas jumpers. It is, honestly, most of the men's section is like £6 Christmas jumpers, generic Christmas jumper X that people are just wearing.
But really, do you want to spend or take time over a Christmas jumper? Because let's be honest, it's one day a year. And what am I going to do with this? Really?
Well, it would be a brave fashion choice, you know, outside of the Christmas.
Exactly. I'm not surprised they've seen, the supermarkets have seen 100% increase in interest in the last couple
compared
of weeks.
Only 100%.
Given we're in mid-December, absolutely. I will go on to a Save the Children website and donate a little bit of money later, just to make me feel even more in the festive spirit.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Well, let's turn our attention to more serious matters. Let's start with national saving bonds or pensioner bonds. Today, the government is expected to release the rates. In the autumn statement, the Chancellor promised they'd pay top rates, and as a result, billions of pounds of pensioners' money is thought to be poised to pour into them. Just let's rewind a little bit and explain what they are, if you would, Lee.
So pensioner bonds were promised in the budget by the Chancellor. And they will be two fixed-rate bonds, one year and another that's a three-year bond. Now, they were expected to pay 2.8% on the 1 year and 4% on the three-year, but the details weren't released last week in the autumn statement as promised, and instead the rates are going to be announced today at 4pm. So we'll find out how market-leading these rates will be. They're expected, even if they're not to be the rates that have been sort of muted in March, still expected to be market leading, but they might not be as juicy as what we're expecting. Savings rates this year have not done an awful amount. You know, they've been stuck, they've dropped a little bit, but they're rock bottom. You know, people aren't used to having rates this low. It just remains to be seen today. We'll know more at 4pm.
Ed?
Well, it's interesting. These are issued by National Savings and Investments, NSNI, and the same people that do the premium bonds, of course. Now, that's a government-backed savings provider. Now, normally, the rules governing NSNI mean that they can't offer too generous a rates because they have a remit where they cannot distort the market for savings rates. Now, this sort of went out of the window when the Chancellor announced pensioner bonds. It's £10 billion worth of money, £10 billion worth of breaks that people can get access to. So they're going to have to be mindful that they can't blow absolutely everything else out of the water when they set these rates. So maybe it will be a bit below what was quoted before. But we know they're going to be very highly subscribed because we know from our readers what they say about savings rates. They want to put their money in somewhere that's going to beat inflation. They're constantly on the lookout, constantly snapping up deals that disappear because they're so oversubscribed. So it's going to be a big rush for these bonds later today, which might be why they're releasing it at 4pm on a Friday, in the hope that the NSNI website won't crash with the demand, because people are going to be waiting to jump on these.
Give us some of the stats and figures, how they compare, how old you have to be, how much you're allowed to put in.
You have to be over 65, so it's open to those who are over 65. Each bond will allow £10,000, a maximum in each. So you could put £20,000, £10,000 in the 1 year, £10,000 in the 3 year. The top 1 year fix at the moment is 1.85%, the market leading. And on a 3 year, it's just 2.5%. You know, if it is 4%, that's quite a big gap, and it's going to mean quite a bit more interest for people. Now, I know I touched on this last week, but you won't be able to take the income monthly, which is how a lot of pensioners will use a savings account. You won't have access to the money until the end of the term. So I think that might put off some people a little bit, but they're going to be much better rates than what's out there at the moment.
If you are eligible, what's the process?
Well, it's the NSNI website is where you want to head. And we're guessing from 4pm there'll be sort of instructions of how you apply for these.
Is it a total win, or are there risks?
It's broadly speaking a big win if you can get your hands on one, because it's government backed. Now most savings providers are perfectly safe, of course, but the NSNI is backed by the government, so it's ultra safe. These aren't ISA savings products. That means that the interest you get is not tax free. Now, people, it's still going to be, it's still good advice to fill up your ISA allowance in a particular year, but people may be tempted into these rates because, frankly, even with the tax break, these are going to be more generous, it seems, than ISAs. But, of course, the money you put into an ISA can be tax-free in the future as well, so it's never bad advice to fill up your ISA allowance. But these are going to be decisions that people have to make. I mean, interestingly, this group of people, you know, people over 65, as has been reported, have been sheltered and looked after a bit better than everybody else. And effectively, this is a giveaway to those people. And the people that will gain the most are the people that have got £20,000 to put in. If as we suspect this is gets snapped up very quickly, then the subject of future budget and autumn statement announcement, are they going to do it again? What's going to happen?
Is there a precedent? Has this something like this been done in the past?
Well, NS&I issue savings bonds and premium bonds all the time.
Yeah.
And they are oversubscribed and they have an annual thing. So that's not necessarily unprecedented. And NS&I, they often offer better rates than you can get from the private providers. But something like this, I mean, in the context of, as Lee said, the rates that you can get elsewhere, these might be twice as good. So, I mean, that's pretty unprecedented.
People have been starved of good savings rates. So that is why, you know, experts are predicting an absolute rush for these products, because savers are desperate for somewhere to get at least a return that beats inflation. And it is very difficult at the moment.
This is money journalists Ed Monk and Lee Boyce from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now let's stick with pensions. We'll look at another story from the website. This is Money. They don't make them like they used to. This is the headline: how workers pay in the same into their pension as in 1975, but get far less back. Well, before we take a look at this story, let's find out a little bit more about pensions in general.
A pension is one of those terms we all hear and think we know about, but often it's subtly misunderstood. If you're one of the increasingly rare people in a final salary occupational pension scheme, the company you work for has provided you with an extremely valuable saving structure which will give you a guaranteed level of income for the rest of your life. It's more likely that you don't have a company scheme and you have a personal pension, or the company won't guarantee your pension payment. These are known as defined contribution schemes. As the title suggests, you don't know what you will get, only what you've contributed. The value of your final pension pot will depend on how well the investments have performed. There are three big advantages of saving a pension. The first is it encourages you to save for your retirement. It enriches the saving habit into your monthly finances and forces you to save for the future. Secondly, if you have a corporate pension, the company is likely to be adding an extra something to the saving each month. Thirdly, and most strikingly of all, the pension contributions you make are tax-free, which means when you add payment to your pension, the government returns the tax you paid and puts it into the pension as well. As a result, more goes into your pension saving plan than you actually put in it. And that's a valuable boost to your financial well-being. Even though there can be good saving mechanisms, money invested in a pension can lose value if the products in which the pension is invested fall in value. Huge changes in the pension regulations were announced in the 2014 budget, to take effect in April 2015. One of the biggest changes removed the requirement of people with a defined contribution pension to buy an annuity. An annuity is a financial product that guarantees an income for the rest of your life. Managing how you contribute to your pension and how you use it when you retire can have a powerful effect on your finances, and it really is something worth spending a little time getting to know how they work.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
So there you go, a little bit about pensions there. The reason being, because we're about to talk about, and I quote, they don't make them like they used to, how workers pay in the same into their pension as in 1975, but get far less back. Ed, lead us off on this one.
There was a big survey by the National Association of Pension Funds looking at how things have changed over time. Mm-hmm. It's an important issue because increasingly people are going to have to look after themselves when it comes to their old age. You know, with the state pension is holding up, but there's no guarantees about it in the future. It's probably going to be important for people to save more under their own steam. And what the survey's showing is that there's a shift, as your little package there talks about, from final salary schemes to defined contribution schemes or money purchase schemes, which are cheaper for companies, which is part of the reason that there's been the switch. But of course, they're less generous and more risky for pension savers. The report goes into that movement, really. There's about a third of the number of people in final salary schemes nowadays than there were in 1975. But actually, that probably hides the fact that a tiny sliver of those schemes are still open for people to join in. People are members of them, but they're not paying in under those terms anymore.
In the past, these final salary schemes were, and you said here, referred to as gold-plated. It's not so common nowadays.
No. You know, companies found that they were making promises to a generation of workers that were becoming incredibly expensive to meet those promises. And it's not hard to see why people live longer now. So you promise someone a pension that's worth 2/3 of their salary and they live for 10 years longer than you think they will.
Do you think by the time we're a pensionable age, there'll be anything like this?
No, I don't think there will be, to be honest with you. I think they're closing at a rate that means really they will disappear. There are still some schemes which can be more generous. Mm-hmm. There are schemes that instead of paying a proportion of final salary, pay career average. You have schemes that are sort of hybrid schemes that are more generous than defined contribution schemes, but not as generous as final salary. So there is room for people to get a decent pension from their employer. But it's worth noting that people have got to act. It's up to individuals to help themselves get a better pension.
It's really interesting what this 40th annual survey by the National Association of Pension Funds shows. It talks about how pension savings, prices and lifestyle have changed since 1975. For example, a loaf of bread costs 16p. It costs around about £1 now. So the average house price was £12,000, not the £213,000 you would have to shell out today. Well, it depends where you live, certainly not in London. Basic weekly state pension back then was £13.30 compared with £113 now. You think, oh, that's not bad. But then had it gone up with RPI inflation, it should actually be around £120 now, although top-ups, of course, mean that you can take home more than this. Let's talk about how our pension's going to be changed.
Well, next year's changes give people the option to get their pension pot and draw it down instead of buying an annuity. We're waiting for that to come in, and there's sort of reasons to be a bit cautious about that. But what it does mean is that for people saving now, the money they put into a pension is a bit more tangible. They're going to see they potentially could retire and start pulling this money down. So I think it's a very good thing when it comes to encouraging saving into these defined contribution pensions, which are less generous. But you will, if you're in a company scheme, you'll find your employer probably matches your contributions, which is free money. It might be delayed. You might have to wait until you retire, obviously, to get it. Mm. But it's free money from your employer. It will be invested. And if you sort of research your options, you can make sure that it's invested in a way that suits you, perhaps a bit more aggressively than maybe the default options for investment are. The advice is to just take advantage of the scheme that you can and make sure you maximise the contributions that you make, because that will help with investment returns, and it will also potentially help with the contributions that your employer pays in as well. So you can act to improve things for yourself.
Lee?
As I say, another stat that was quite interesting from this was your life expectancy in 1975. So once you reached 65, if you was a man, you was expected to live for another 13 years. Now that is 22 years. People are living an extra 10 years. So I think it's important next year that while you can obviously take some of this money, I think you've just got to make sure that you're not going to just go and blow it on the Lamborghini unless you can really sort of afford it and know that in later life, you're going to be comfortable. It's a case of trusting people with their pensions to do sort of like the right thing.
Yeah, that's right. And the sort of evidence and thinking on this is sort of mixed, because yes, you've got the potential, you know, people are worried that they'll have access to this money and blow it all. I think the circumstances where people pull down a lot of their pension and perhaps pay too much tax on it or whatever it is, it's probably going to be because they need to repay debt. They might have a mortgage to clear. And they might reason that it's actually worth taking that tax hit to clear a mortgage, for example, and that'll be up to them. The people that have a decent amount of money in there, actually, there is some thinking that actually, because they're so cautious about it running out, they won't pull down enough, sort of being too cautious, and that's the experience in places like Australia. Fears that people are just going to blow the lot are probably wide at the mark.
Have we changed the way that we are sticking money into our pension pots, i.e. the proportion of our wages?
Well, actually, I thought one of the most interesting things in the survey was that the amount that workers put in is about the same, 6% or 8% of their salary. Mm. But it's the employer's contribution which has fallen, of course, and that's simply because the contribution to a final salary scheme would be far more. It'd be something like 21% of your salary that they would put in, which is obviously generous by anyone's standards, and that falls down to sort of 6 or 7 again. So workers are putting in about the same. It's tough for anyone to put more than 8, 9, 10%. I mean, that's a big chunk of your take-home pay, and people are reluctant to put that much in. But the more you can put in, clearly, the more you're going to get out at the end.
And also, I mean, saying, you know, in an ideal world, we would put in more of our wages into pensions, but some people, for instance, my generation, a lot of student debt, and you're thinking, well, that's already coming out of my wage. Wage growth isn't high. Living costs are going up all the time. So it's difficult to put more and more in, but if you can, it's great, because as Ed says, it's free money from your employer. They're going to match what you put in.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now let's take a look at our next story with This Is Money journalist Ed Monk and Lee Boyce. Of course, this is the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Well, in the past few weeks have proved that we've gone, well, let's be honest, a little bit crazy when it comes to Christmas spending. Not all of us, but certainly plenty of us can probably own up to this. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Manic Monday, Mayhem Monday, I don't know, lots of Mondays with titles. Well, it's very likely that some people's credit cards have, let's be honest, taken a bit of a bashing, a bit lighter than perhaps they were before. So your colleague Amy Andrew has been looking at some of the best credit cards out there and appealing balance transfer rates. What's your view, overall view, opinion of credit cards? A good idea, bad idea, just a temptation to spend beyond our means?
They're certainly that, but they, of course, can be used responsibly and really to the advantage of borrowers if you get it right. The big question is, will you get it right? Because the best balance transfer deals now are getting on for 3 years of interest-free debt. That's a lender taking on your debt and giving you its interest-free for 3 years. So that's why that's very advantageous. Mm-hmm. But of course, why do they do that? It's because they're trying to, or they understand that the people that take on this debt might take on more debt in other ways on other cards and make their money.
Lee, your views?
Well, this comes off the back of HSBC extending its balance transfer card from 30 months to 34 months. Now, there's always some sort of battle to have the longest balance transfer card. Barclaycard is more often than not leading the way in this. Now, me and Ed were talking about this on the way in, saying that actually very few people end up with this 34-month deal.
Yeah.
It's a very small sliver of people that actually get accepted for it. They play on that. So
how does that work? Who's likely to get it? Who isn't? How much are you likely to get?
Well, the rule is, for credit card ads, they have to give 51% of the people that are accepted that rate. So if all the people that are accepted, half of them are going to get that rate. But, of course, you don't know how many people are not accepted for it. And that's completely at their discretion. Clearly, it's to do with your credit history. I mean, this is a slightly murky area from the point of view that it's difficult to know what they're basing decisions on. Mm-hmm. Is it because they want a rock-solid borrower who's definitely going to pay back on time? That might be very safe, but it might not make them very much money.
Exactly.
They might want the people that actually service a debt and pay minimum payments and have that debt hanging around for longer, because that's more profitable for them. What is actually quite typical is for you to apply for a 34-month card, and they'll say, well, you can't have that. But how about this one, which has got 18 months of balance transfer, but also maybe interest-free on purchases? So suddenly you've gone from being a customer that wanted to get rid of debt interest-free to get rid of debt interest-free, but also have a load of interest-free spending over here that and people get tempted into it. And so that's often, you know, this is a marketing game for credit cards.
And also, is it true, say you've got a £4,000 debt on one card, you want to transfer it over, you apply for that, often they'll say, well, no, but you can put £2,000.
Exactly that. They can offer you the limits that they want to offer you. It can be a frustrating process. I mean, if you've been in the position of applying for a card and then you get rejected for it and you sort of ask why, and they say, well, it's based on information in your credit file and you can go to a credit file company, and they'll say, well, it's up to the bank. There's no rhyme or reason. You just have to accept their decision.
And it also depends on you to a certain extent as to what you want these cards for and what you are like as a borrower.
If you really wanted to make the most sort of advantageous use of credit cards, 0% interest on purchases, you might look for a rewards card that gives you reward points or cash back or whatever it is. And you could do an awful lot of your spending on those cards. Now, of course, what that does is create big credit card debts that you then have to service. You either have to pay them back, or if you've got, you know, maybe use a balance transfer card. The important, always the advice with credit cards is be very clear on what you're using it for. If it's to clear debt, make sure you clear the debt. If it's to take advantage of interest-free purchases, fine, but have a plan in place to pay that back.
So what are the market leaders then?
You've got the Barclaycard one at 34 months. That comes
this
with
is the longest interest-free period card. So if you're looking for something where you want to pay off...
Indeed, yeah. So if you've got maybe like an overdraft and like some previous credit cards, you pay a fee to move the balance across. Mm-hmm. So with the Barclaycard one, it's 34 months and it comes with a 2.99% fee. if you move your money across within 60 days. Now, HSBC have, as I say, up there from 30 to 34 months. It comes with a 3.3% fee, so slightly higher fee the Barclay card, and then there's a range of others such as Halifax and Lloyds that have 33 months.
But these APRs afterwards, 18.9%.
Yeah, well that's what they're looking, you know, to do. It's a bit like take an example of a savings rate. You might have a bonus that's nice and juicy for that first year, and then it might drop away. And they're playing up on that. That's what they want. That's how they make their money.
So it really depends. If you think you can pay it off within a certain amount of time, is it worth it? If not, think again. If you don't manage to pay it off within a certain amount of time, can you then transfer it to somewhere else?
Well, there's no guarantee you can. You've got that debt on that card and you need to clear it. Now, if you can shift that debt onto another balance transfer card or even take a cheaper loan or whatever it is, then that would be good advice to do it. But, of course, you're then reliant on a new lender taking you on as a customer.
So if you've defaulted at any time or your credit history's changed,
the world has changed by that time. You know, who knows? And actually, of course, this is what went on in the sort of, you know, the good old days, the bad old days, when lots of cheap credit was around. Rate tarts, as they were called, you would be able to do this all the time, and there wasn't really an issue with it. But of course, it's changed a lot since then.
Is it worrying then, therefore, given the credit crunch and the bubble that was built up, that we are seeing so many different cards and different rates like this to encourage people to spend on them?
I think a key thing to think about this is, you know, we're running the lead up to Christmas at the moment, and you mentioned about all these Black Fridays and Manic Mondays and Mayhem Mondays, and people feel like they have to spend an absolute fortune on Christmas, for example. You know, there was a survey out a couple of weeks ago that shows Brits spend the most in the whole of Europe on Christmas presents. And I think if you're going to do that, make sure you save gently over the year rather than just getting yourself into a cycle of credit card debt where you're having to rely on balance transfer cards and, you know, this, that and the other. It's just, I think people need to be a little bit more, you know, financially astute in some situations, and we don't want to sleepwalk back into a situation where a few years ago people were stuck with debts. You know, there was no balance transfer cards really to go to because all the lending was, you know, the lending dried up. So just a bit of sensible advice, really. Don't get suckered in by all these, you know, crazy retailer days.
If only we could all do that, Ed.
I was just going to say, on the sort of range of cards and, you know, the variety of them, people just need to remember that these are dreamt up in credit card companies to sell and to be marketed. And actually, it's interesting, one of the major banks, RBS, owns NatWest. Their chief executive has banned these types of cards because he says, look, I work in a bank and I know basically the damage they can do. We won't have these introductory periods. We won't have 0% for a while and then it jumps up because it traps people. Now, that doesn't mean it will trap everybody. And if people are responsible and take responsibility, they needn't be trapped. But clearly banks...
That's quite serious that someone in the RBS has come out and said something like that.
Yeah, but it stands to reason. It's been known about credit cards that you need to be wary of the traps. And actually, a lot of the worst pitfalls have been removed, you know, through regulation. Things that made borrowers pay higher rates of interest and not be able to clear debt and things like that have gone. But still, the premise is there that... the potential is that people get tempted into more debt.
Yeah. If you are sensible and you're trying to repay your debts and nothing more, this can be a very useful tool to have. So we've spoken about the longest interest-free period cards that come with a fee. There are cards out there where you have no fee. Tesco Bank charges certainly no fee, but I think it only offers 12 months at that rate. But I'm assuming on your thinking again that not everyone will be offered that. Fluid also, Lloyds Bank's Platinum Purchase Card, that's 0.4%. So very low, not 0%, but still very low nonetheless. But all these are sort of 10, 12 months, not the kind of 33 months that we were talking about earlier.
Well, that's right. And how attractive they are depends on the sort of debts that you have to shift on. I mean, it's a sort of paradox, really, that the people that have lots and lots of debt are probably less likely to be accepted for a card because they've got lots and lots of debt. There's actually tools that you out there that you can use that will give you an indication of whether you're likely to be accepted. And that spares you multiple applications, which is not a good idea. You should not do that because that in itself can count against you from a credit score point of view.
Because if you are someone who's racked up quite a lot of debt and you're unlikely to get this, you can transfer over, of course, to the best low rate balance transfers. But if you are in a situation like that, it might be better to perhaps get advice. You are hearing from This Is Money journalists Ed Monk and Lee Boyce, of course. That's the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost, and you're listening to Consuming Issues, making the pound in your pocket hopefully go that little bit further, especially today, where I welcome Ed Monk and Lee Boyce from the award-winning financial website Money section of the Mail Online. This is Money on behalf of us, the consumer. They investigate everything from scams through to how to keep your costs down on household bills and the best deals. And of course, last week we were hearing about whiskey as well. Well, let's turn our attention to a story that you've written about, and this is where I go incredibly quiet, because I know very little. I hold my hand up and say I know a lot about some things, but not anything about cars. Who's the petrol head here?
I'm from Essex, so of course I'm a petrol head. It's a land of Ford Escorts.
To which Ed just pointed at you there. You. That would make sense as you wrote this. Now, we still love the Fiesta, Focus and Corsa, but we don't buy French, and it's goodbye Mondeo, man. What's
That's
this
right.
All about,
it's been replaced
Lee?
By Qashqai Dad. Basically, last week the SMMT, which is the sort of manufacturing stats, showed that we're on course this year to buy as many new cars as we did 10 years ago. So new car sales are at 2004 levels.
That's quite astonishing, isn't it?
It is quite.
We're only a few years after
exactly.
One of the worst crises of our financial.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, in 2011, it had dipped under 2 million cars sold. This year, they expect it to be more sort of closer to 2.5 million. You know, almost 500,000 cars more being sold this year. So, yeah, people are back in enjoying new cars again and buying new cars. So
it's goodbye Mondeo man, but I'm told by my producer Annie, not just Mondeo man.
Mondeo woman, that was my first car. And Mondeos are absolutely enormous. The rest of my family wouldn't drive it, so it soon became my car. It's like driving a tank or something, but I loved it. As a 17-year-old, I thought I was the bee's knees.
So this report only goes back to 2004, but you guys look quite young, so I imagine first cars around 2004?
Slightly before that.
What was your first car?
A Nissan Micra, destroyed in a crash.
And Julie?
French, Saxo. And now we don't buy French cars anymore. Fallen out of favour.
Yeah, mine was an Audi.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, from my dad.
That's right for some, isn't it?
From my dad. It didn't start. It didn't start. No, the car didn't start. Then the next one I got, again from my dad, was a Peugeot Estate, and the whole exhaust fell off. Clearly, it didn't work out too well for me in the Audi or the French one, but we're not buying French.
Well, I just think that there's a more choice of cars now. So I think actually to get in this top 10 selling cars, they have to shift far less than they did 10 years ago.
But we still love our Fords.
We do love our Fords.
Still top of the list.
Fiesta, you know, has always been a very economical car, ideal first-time buyer car, and people find it quite reliable. So, you know, naturally they've stayed as one of the most popular cars sold in Britain. And I think the most recent version is quite an attractive car, really, if you compare to the Fiesta 10 years ago. So Ford Fiesta now is the number one selling car. 10 years ago it was number three, so that's race to the top. But in the list 10 years ago, interestingly, there was two Peugeots in that list and two Renaults, and they don't feature at all anymore. They've been replaced by the Qashqai, Audi A3, Fiat 500 is a bit of a popular one now. Again, economical city car, people like them, and the Nissan Juke. So the Nissan Juke and the Nissan Qashqai are quite big cars, sort of crossover, you know, 4x4 type vehicles. We kind of hinted in this story that maybe people were, you know, getting families, and it's an ideal family runaround and relatively good price.
Yeah, that's right. And they seem to have sort of shifted from a, you know, Renault Megane sort of family wagon thing to a sort of 4x4 Qashqai.
Exactly.
That seems to be like the more of the family choice these days.
And it's a bit more, it looks a bit more stylish, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you, because I've got no. Oh no, there's helpful pictures here. If you do go online to This Is Money, we still love the Fiesta, Focus, and Corsa. Lee Boyce's brilliant column here. They do have pictures, which is great. So you can now know what a Peugeot 307 looks like. If you don't, most people probably will. But I go everywhere by train. Is it perhaps in the past we thought we were getting a good deal when we went second hand, and actually you can get a better deal with a new car?
There's some really good deals to be had on a new car now. You know, these dealerships are looking to shift cars, make these stats look good. I mean, if you look across Europe at new car sales, and nothing like what's happening in Britain. You know, sales here are great, but what the big shift has been towards is more of these sort of higher contracts. So you'll put down a deposit and then you'll make monthly instalments. Now, after 3 years, you can either pay the balloon payment and keep the car, or you can trade it in and repeat the process. So it's almost like leasing a car every sort of 3 years. And that's helping bump up the stats. I mean, I think it's quite a large proportion of people buying cars that way. You get the benefit of a new car, the warranty and all that jazz, and then after 3 years, you can do the same again.
And of course, what this does down the line is create a bit of a bubble in new car sales now, which means there's a glut of secondhand cars down the line. So there's potential for cheaper prices in 3 years when some of these people sort of trade in the new model.
Does it reflect where cars are being built at the moment? Where is hot right now in the world, as it were, in the auto world?
Sunderland is
Nissan.
Yes, with the Qashqai.
Sunderland is hot anyway, let's be honest. But in terms of the auto world,
It's great. And it actually, the number of cars being built in Britain is on the rise. So that can be a good thing. There's investment from Jaguar Land Rover, for example, which is more sort of Birmingham way. But in terms of where these cars have been built, I mean, it's a real mixed bag. I don't think we can particularly say, you know, where's hot and where's not. But I just think that maybe the French models just aren't as popular anymore. And there was lots of, you know, if you look at the reader comments about French cars, for example.
Yeah, what have they been saying? What have your readers been saying?
Well, you've just sold us the exhaust pipe, fell off your Peugeot. So, I mean,
well, if
that's reflected as a whole over, you know, people's feelings of French cars, I mean,
I'm sure other Peugeots are better than mine. I did run it to the ground. So, just finally, so the data shows that more and more diesel's being sold.
That's right, So 10 years ago, there was 1.7 million unleaded petrol cars being sold, opposed to about 800,000 diesel. Mm. Now, the last couple of years, there's more diesel car sales than unleaded.
The economic argument for diesel, maybe it's more economical. That reflect the fact that maybe diesel engines are better now, and that they're closer in performance to petrol cars, and so people are less bothered. There's less of a sort of stigma having a sort of, you know, thing that sounds like a tractor when you fire it up.
But what they usually say, if you drive more than sort of 10,000 to 12,000 miles a year, you're best off getting a diesel because they're more economical in the long run. But if you live in a city or somewhere where you just use it as a little runaround, I wouldn't recommend getting a diesel. You won't see any financial sort of benefits from doing it.
I think actually one of the most, as a sort of non-car owning, London living person, the most interesting thing was that the favourite colours of cars.
Oh, great, yeah.
So apparently it was silver in 2004.
Yeah, okay. But now,
and this surprised me. For 2014, it's white.
Well, actually, I have read about this before, and the reason that people are picking white, apparently, is to match their gadgets. So, like, an iPhone is white. It's all about sort of that. Yeah, no,
Annie, do you have any white gadgets?
Hang on, what's this? Oh, look, it's a white iPhone.
Oh,
there we go.
Does.
So you get a car to match it.
I get dirty really quickly, white cars.
Okay. Oh, it beats being in Essex. You usually get a luminous lights underneath.
I'm so glad you came out with the Essex comment. I'm so gladly, as an Essex boy yourself.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
We talked about cars for a little bit longer than I thought I was comfortable with, but that's okay. But now let's turn on to a subject that I do feel a lot more comfortable with, sat here in a very cosy Christmas jumper. So let's do a Christmas story next. Why not? I am here with This Is Money journalist Ed Monk and Lee Boyce, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Sticking with the Christmas theme, turkeys.
Surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, this is always really, really popular, this story. You do it every year.
Tell me this is a new one, though. You've not just rehashed last year's or the year before's. Okay, that's good.
Comprehensive research of the turkey market. So I guess what won't be a surprise is to hear that the discount supermarkets, Aldi and Lidl, do very well. If you look at the sort of total prices, that you're probably going to get the cheapest turkey there.
But where can you get the best quality? Who's done a taste? Someone done a taste test here.
Well, people have done taste tests. Money Saving Expert told us that in tests that they did, the budget ones held their own and came out fine versus the premium ones. But of course, lots of people will want to push the boat out and get something sort of organic and free range and maybe local to them.
Mm. What's the price range that you can buy for a cheap turkey all the way up to some of the most expensive ones?
If you want the absolute cheapest turkey you can get, you should go for a frozen one. Which
I don't think I've ever had a frozen turkey.
They're significantly cheaper. You can get one for as cheap as $9.99 in Lidl if you really wanted a frozen one. Mm. But a bit further up the price chain, the premium turkeys are in supermarkets for as low as £23 in Aldi. But you can spend, I'm looking at one here, Sainsbury's go up to £70 or more, you know, for a turkey. I think if you go to organic free range and all the rest of it, you can get very expensive indeed.
Just get the turkey crown. It's all about the turkey crown, I believe.
Right.
It's much cheaper.
What's a turkey crown, someone?
All right, so that's the top bit of the turkey, the big, like, fat, juicy bit, the
right.
Breast
no
of the
legs.
Turkey.
Lack of legs.
Get rid of the legs, get rid of the bones, just
we
go
have
for the meat.
We have a turkey crown every year and it's very delicious.
Apologies to vegetarians listening right now. I'm a reluctant meat eater and an even more reluctant meat cooker. How do they test all this?
They have the overall price, but they also have price per kilo.
Because of course some are different sizes, aren't they? Some will feed a certain number of people, some will feed
exactly.
more.
Exactly. To be honest with you, the truth of this is we wanted to publish this because people are sort of interested and like to think of it as a starting point before they go off and do the big Christmas shop. People will know exactly what they want. They'll know how many people they have to feed.
Yeah.
And one thing that we did stick in the story, because we know people like to sort of buy locally, to possibly cut the bills there. If you have a nice butcher that has queues around the corner at Christmas time, go in there and ask them where they get their turkeys from, because the chances are, if it's a local farm or producer, they'll also stock other shops in the area, perhaps less sort of fancy butchers.
Yeah.
And you might actually be able to get exactly the same thing for cheaper.
I was kicking myself last week for not asking Mark Shoffman, who tried an £18,000 whiskey, whether it was worth it. He did mention to me afterwards that it did go down very smoothly, didn't burn, so whether it was worth an £18,000 bottle, I don't know. But in your humble opinion, lads, do you think that price matters when it comes to quality? Would you rather pay a little bit more and you think you're going to get a better taste? Can you scrimp on some things at Christmas, basically?
I think a turkey, the meat isn't particularly, you know, it hasn't got the most strong taste, is it? It's not like a fillet steak, or, you know, if you get a cheap steak, you know you've got a cheap steak. I think with a turkey, you can get away with it a bit more. It's swamped with gravy, you eat it with a bit of stuffing. You know, I've got no problem with getting a budget turkey from a frozen turkey.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to have a budget turkey this Christmas, let's face it. Yeah. I've had a free-range turkey before. Obviously, they're really expensive. I didn't buy it. But it was really good and it did taste different.
So do let us know if you think there's a difference in taste and where you're going to buy your turkey.
We should. Let's do a taste test.
Next week,
yeah.
If you bring Rachel in, she can cook it for us in a special money-saving way and then bring a turkey in. Lads, thank you very, very much for joining us here on Consuming Issues on Share Radio. Thank you so much to Ed Monk and Lee Boyce from This Is Money.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.